This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
This event is co-hosted by the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services and the Human Rights Law Centre. It's an extremely important partnership that those two organisations have. The National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services is the representative body for the 8 legal services across the country. And the Human Rights Law Centre has always been a great support to us and has worked collaboratively with us in a number of matters and both in a policy space as well. I'm going to introduce my speakers in a moment, the rest of the panel, but I just wanted to start off with something else. Witnesses said he was punched, knocked to the ground, and then kicked before being dragged by his hair into the paddy wagon and taken as one of 6 Aboriginal people to the police station. A witness who lived opposite said that she saw 8 policemen beat the Aboriginal men until they were limp before dragging them inside the police station. John Pat died of head injuries that night, but also suffered 2 broken ribs, a torn aorta, and a major blood vessel to the heart. The others weren't given medical assistance until the following day. John Pat's body was moved and washed before forensic photos were taken. The police uniforms and boots were not provided to forensics until a month following the death. All 5 officers charged were acquitted and reinstated. The other Aboriginal men were charged with assaulting police and jailed. It's been 25 years since the tabling of the report in the Royal Commission to Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. A lot has happened in that time. We've had some significant changes, and possibly one of the most significant has been some of the Aboriginal justice agreements around the country. But over 400 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have died in custody since the 1991 recommendations. The Royal Commission examined 99 deaths between 1980 and 1989, with a further 24 assessed as outside the terms of reference. It included 88 men and 11 women, 3 juveniles. The deaths ranged from the ages of 14 to 60 years old, with half being removed from their families as children. The Commission was to consider the factors that caused the death and that contributed to the high incarceration rates. Significantly, the Royal Commission was also to consider the broader social underlying contributing factors. The final report was tabled on April 15th, 1991. 339 recommendations were made. It found that the high rates of death directly reflected the high rates of incarceration. I'm joined on the stage tonight by an amazing panel of guests. To my immediate left, I would like to acknowledge Magistrate Rose Feller. Magistrate Feller is a Wotjobaluk Wambal Wambal woman. She was born and raised in Melbourne, and she was educated in the northern suburbs of Melbourne. Magistrate Feller has enjoyed a distinguished legal career, and as you might imagine, we could probably talk about all of those achievements for quite some time. But I'd ultimately like to let you know that that culminated in her appointment as the first Indigenous magistrate in Victoria in 2013. And I'd like to welcome Rose to the stage.
Thank you, Carla. Thanks, everyone. Really honoured to be here. Thanks.
Shane Duffy, thank you for joining us. Shane is a descendant of the Kalkadoon people from Mount Isa in northwest Queensland. Shane has worked in the human services industry for over 2 decades. He's serving as the Chief Executive Officer of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services in Queensland. And he is currently the co-chair of the Change the Record campaign. Shane was the most recent chair of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services and has also been a chair of the Australian Legal Assistance Forum. Shane's experience broadly covers local, regional, state, national and international advocacy on issues that impact disproportionately and adversely upon his people. I'd like to welcome Shane to the stage. Ruth, last but certainly not least, Ruth is the Director of Legal Advocacy at the Human Rights Law Centre. She previously worked as a senior lawyer at the Centre for Interview Justice under the directorship of former Attorney General and Deputy Premier, the Honourable Rob Hulls. In this role, Ruth was responsible for delivering a Commonwealth Government-funded report detailing innovative reforms for improving the criminal justice system's response to sexual assault. Ruth is currently on the board of the Women's Legal Service in Victoria, a community legal centre providing services to women experience violence and relationship breakdown. Thanks for joining us, Ruth.
Thanks for having me.
No worries. And finally, I'm Carly Warner. I'm a Tasmanian Aboriginal woman and I'm very pleased to be with you tonight. I'm the current Executive Officer of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services, NATSLS. Most recently, I was a solicitor at the Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service and have experience in the criminal, family and civil practices. So thank you for joining us, and we're just going to move through a range of questions so that you can try and extract some of those insights of this wonderful panel. So, Magistrate Feller, I might start with you, if I can.
Sure.
You're the first Aboriginal magistrate in Victoria, as we mentioned, which is quite a remarkable achievement. And we're just hoping that you could tell us a little bit about the impact that the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody actually had on you at the time, and then possibly how that's actually influenced you in your decisions in your career.
Sure. Well, first of all, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people and the Boorong people and the people of the Kulin Nation, as is our custom, so I wish to do that. I also just, Carly, think it's really important that we do acknowledge the people that have passed as part of the deaths in custody. It is amazing that it's 25 years since all of that happened, and I'm really honoured to be here to talk about hopefully what changes and what things have taken place that, from Victoria's perspective, things that we have put in place to try and rectify and remedy those things so that it doesn't continue to happen. But there's always room to improve. Mm. Answering your question, I was starting off very young. One of the first jobs I did was working in ATSIC, and one of the roles, one of my colleagues was working on some of the Ricky Dick recommendations, and it was very interesting way back then to see the work he was doing. I then went off on different tangents and worked in different areas and commenced studying doing my law degree. And when I had the opportunity, I started working with Rob Hulls, who was the Attorney General at the time, on working on some of the initiatives that had arisen from the very first Victorian Aboriginal Justice Agreement. And I was tasked, the section I was working in, tasked to establish the Crury Courts, the very first being in Shepparton and Broadmeadows, increasing the number of Aboriginal people that were bail justices, community legal education, as well as there was one other that I've lost, can't actually remember at the time, but there was also a requirement upon us ensure that we were reporting back to the Aboriginal Justice Forum that was created through government and also stakeholders of government and the Victorian Aboriginal community, responding to the implementation of these recommendations in the Justice Agreement, that the very basis was from the 330 recommendations from the Royal Commission into deaths in custody. And so really I worked on those things and really got to see firsthand what the issues were for community, what some of the resistance was, and there was a lot of distrust, I have to say, with respect to government implementing these programs, and it really did need to be a partnership because it wasn't going to succeed, especially the Crew Courts were not going to succeed if it wasn't a collaborative approach. And to my great delight, it's gone from strength to strength in my view.
Absolutely. And Shane, how have you found the recommendations, the actual implementation of them? Because it's recommendation one that they were to report annually on the implementation of the Rickitic recommendations.
Well, I suppose if I use the Queensland experience, up until about 12 years ago, there was a funded body by the federal government and they developed their Which Way report in Queensland. So there were Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people employed within Brisbane that monitored every government agency that was identified within the Royal Commission's recommendations. So as a part of that process was the ongoing monitoring and evaluation, and how they decided whether or not the recommendation was implemented, whether they'd say accepted, not accepted, or ongoing. And as I said, 12 years ago, the funds were removed from the federal government when all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander legal services were put out to mainstream tender by the Howard former attorney, Philip Ruddick. So we don't have any monitoring processes in Queensland.
Sure. And federally, I don't think there are any since ATSIC has been abolished.
No, that's right. And look, we still say that the 339 recommendations are just as relevant today as they were 25 years ago. We still say it's the blueprint. Where it fails, and if I could talk about the Queensland Police Service, they say they've implemented the vast majority of the recommendations. The challenges are it may have been implemented, but it was implemented in policy, not in legislation. And as we know, policy is bastardised and misinterpreted. I know of some 400 complaints over the last 6 years that our people have had the strength to come forward with the fear of repercussion from the Queensland Police Service to come forward and make complaints. What we've found out all those, bar two, is that peers investigating peers, one of the recommendations, police don't investigate police. Only two people have ever been held to account out of those 400 or so. And the vast majority of the recommendations that come back from the investigating officers is that the police need to undertake further training.
Absolutely. So how are you doing this? I mean, you've been advocating for the rights of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people for decades now. You're the CEO of ATSORS Queensland, co-chair of Change the Record. What drives you?
My mother.
Good answer.
My mother, she says, always says to your boy, she reckon, you know, you can, oh, I can't use them words, but Mum always says, don't get caught up in your own importance, boy. And it can happen, as all of us. But she says, you remain humble. You remember this is not only your obligation, it's your responsibility to your family, your countrymen, and your elders since time began. So my mum's been my strength. And I always talk about Aboriginal men who, you know, live in tall buildings and beat their chests, because our true social fabric strengtheners are our women. And I said, there's a lot of King Kongs, but there's no tall buildings out in some of those communities. So I really, my mum is my strength. She's my acid test. She's my mother.
Beautiful. Thank you. Ruth, I might even sort of segue in here now. I'm not going to talk about your mum, but I would like you to talk about the Human Rights Law Centre's been in has challenged a number of high court decisions. Sorry, has challenged a number of things in the higher courts and a number of policies that have led to the overrepresentation of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. So things like the paperless arrests in the Northern Territory. Have these legal challenges resulted in much change?
I think I would answer optimistically, but maybe I've got a vested interest in that. I think to just go back a step, the reason that the Human Rights Law Centre is so committed to challenging unfair laws is because one of the key, or the key recommendation of the Royal Commission was that every state and territory and the federal government must commit to reducing the rates at which Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are locked up. And if we look around the country today, probably we might be able to exclude some good performing or well-meaning jurisdictions. Very much most jurisdictions are going in the opposite direction, and certainly imprisonment rates having doubled since the Royal Commission demonstrate that. And so if we take as an example what happened, I think it was about 3 years ago now in the Northern Territory, whereby the former government now introduced paperless arrest laws, laws which allowed police, gave police the power to lock people up for minor offences that were quite astonishing, like failing to keep your front yard clean and playing an instrument so as to annoy. We were really concerned with the laws and the impact that we thought they would be having. I should say it was the Aboriginal Legal Service in the top end that alerted us to the laws, and we worked really closely with them, and both of us were really concerned with the likely impact that the laws would have on Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory. And so we did a Freedom of Information application, and I having even lived and worked in the Northern Territory, was astonished with what it came back with, that in the first, I think it was 3 or 4 months of operation, they had been used over 2,000 times, and in over 80% of the cases they were used against Aboriginal people. And if you think that the Northern Territory has a population in the entire Northern Territory of around 115,000 people, that's, and most of those arrests were in Darwin, that was really extraordinary. And so we challenged that case on a number of grounds in the High Court, and we ultimately lost, or we like to call it a partial win. it was a partial win in that some of the powers were wound back. But it was really disappointing, actually, to see the High Court not really turn their mind, in my deeply respectful opinion, to the realities on the ground, that being locked up for 4 hours in custody is actually a really serious breach of liberty. And while the case was on foot, an Aboriginal man, Mr. Langdon, tragically died in custody, and the coroner made scathing recommendations and essentially said that that man deserved to die a free man. And so it really drove home for us, and also the Aboriginal Legal Service, who would be seeing injustice on a day-to-day basis, just how detrimental these laws are that risk the reality of more and more Aboriginal people being locked up. I should say we've got another case that the High Court has just given us special leave to appeal in. That's challenging similar arrest practices under a different piece of legislation. So I'm hopeful that the fact that they've given us special leave might indicate that we'll have a different outcome this time. But watch this space for later this year. More than a partial win.
Absolutely. So, Magistrate Feller, it's recommendation 92 of the Rikidik report that states that imprisonment should be utilised only as a sanction of last resort. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the impacts of the legislative schemes here in Victoria and of any alternatives to imprisonment that you have available? And then perhaps a third aspect to that question, and I can definitely repeat it for you later on, is I'm sure there actually are a number of lawyers in the room. And so how can lawyers actually assist to try and advocate that custodial sentences, you know, are not the option for their clients?
Just following on from what Ruth has said, we've undergone recently, in the last probably 5 years, some legislative reform, and some of the sentencing options that we've had have been removed from us, such as the abolition of suspended sentences in 2014. And a lot of, there was obviously a lot of discussion about what that meant for as a sentencing practice. And it really did see that there was that sentencing option being removed, where there was a concern about will judicial officers sentence up or sentence down? That is up the sentencing scale. And where someone may have been previously afforded a community corrections order but had regularly or repeatedly breached the order, one might argue that they're no longer suitable for a further community corrections order, especially if there's not adequate support services attached to that order that can afford the person programs that addresses the underlying reasons as to why they might offend. The Royal Commission and many other reports since that time have highlighted, and cases I might also indicate, outlined what a lot of the difficulties are and what the causes of some of the high representation of Aboriginal people in custody and in the criminal justice system. So there's a need clearly to find solutions, and some of those might be particular programs. Now, if that sentencing option is no longer available, then you're confronted with a further community corrections order where corrections may be saying they're no longer suitable or imprisonment. And sometimes, because of a person's history, and I've had it said to me in court previously, I don't want to go on a 12-month order, I'll just go on and do a short term. So really it's trying to also motivate and try and gently encourage that sometimes whilst that might seem like it's the better option for you today, it's most certainly not, and it's never a suggestion that we would be wanting to sentence any person, but certainly with the very high rates in Victoria is when you look at the statistics of people being incarcerated, especially our Aboriginal people, it's quite shameful, really. And but in terms of answering your question about how solicitors could assist, here in Victoria, certainly on bail applications, we have 3A of the Bail Act that talks about a person's Aboriginality and how that must be communicated to the court with an expectation that if it's a position where they're in show cause, it can assist. If you can persuade a magistrate about he's a Wadjabulluk man, and I say that because it's my people, a Wadjabulluk man, and he's connected to his people and he's connected to country, and that's how he liaises and what cultural rights he enjoys, the likelihood of him failing to appear at court, or if this is sort of close to community, and you can tie it to his risk of re-offending, then it's going to be very persuasive to a magistrate. And I was also talking about with young children, there's been amendments to our Bail Act also with respect to 3B of the Bail Act, and talking about really turning your mind to a focus on reuniting with family, education, not at the stigma of being incarcerated or placed in detention. There's a lot of those things that are really very pertinent and we need to turn our minds to. And if solicitors and barristers turn their minds to those things, it can be, and I've seen it happen, it can be the difference between bail or not. I think Deborah Glass, our Ombudsman, released a report into the prisons in September of last year, and I would encourage people to read the report because it talked about the cost of incarceration and the number of sentences that and the types of sentences people are receiving. And she had quoted in her report that I think at January 2015 we hit our highest ever prison population in Victoria, and that was in excess of 6,300 people. The projected figures as at 2018 is 8,300. And that's staggering when you look at that. And when you look at our stats of the percentage of Aboriginal people that are in custody now, and the percentage we are of the population, I'm really genuinely concerned about what that space may look like in the future. So we really, and when she goes on to say that some of these sentences, per person, per day, it's costing about $270 a day, which equates to about $98,000 a year. And you look at the type of sentence that the duration of the sentences that people may be getting, you're looking at close to $295,000 for that sentence for that one prisoner. And if you actually sought to, and it's not for me to tell government how to, but certainly one might suggest that if we look at the amount of money that's going to cost mm-hmm. us and fund some programs that address the underlying issues of offending, then I really do think that we could really get some runs on the board and reduce those statistics to a point where ultimately people aren't going to jail.
Yeah. It's such a high figure, isn't it? Like $3.4 billion, you know, governments across Australia are spending to actually keep people in prison. And Shane, you know, can you share some of your insights? You know, at the time of Reykjavik, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were 6 times more likely to be imprisoned than non-Aboriginal people. Now in 2016, we're looking at 13 times more likely. What's some of the things that we should be doing?
Well, poor policy. Pardon me. Poor public policy, very weak legislation, laws and policy that's created in complete isolation from the experts, such as the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services, our childcare, our health services. It's that real... I talk about this transformational learning where government needs to undo and unlearn what they've known and done before and make way for new learnings. And that's, you know, we talk about a bipartisan approach. The legislation and public policy needs to be done in conjunction. Put your politics aside and realise that we need long-lasting strategies mm-hmm. through those two platforms to ensure that, in a true sense, we reduce the rates that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are going to jail. So it's $34 billion that the federal government invests on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander programs. And yet, in each state and territory, do I call you Your Honour down
Rose.
Here?
No, Rose. You call me Rose.
Rose. Sorry, always respectful. $34 billion. So we know money alone is not necessarily the answer. Mm. It's just how those dollars are distributed to the services, the social services on the ground that address the root causes or the drivers of why people offend. Women is the fastest growing industry. Sure. In this country. And, you know, our grannies, our mums, and as I talked before about the strength of our women and how they keep that strong bond of the social fabric in the community, if they're not around, what does the future look like for our children? So there's a lot of challenges, Carly, and you know, I always talk about Malcolm Turnbull or Bill Shorten or whoever wants to be the Prime Minister of Australia. Governments need to work together, put their political difference aside, come up with a bipartisan process which extends beyond parliamentary terms and really engage with the experts in the field. Aboriginal Legal Services, I'll get killed if I don't say Torres Strait Islander too from where I come mm-hmm. from, but Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Legal Services have been around for 44 years. Mm-hmm. How are they engaging with us? Is it meaningful engagement? Because you go to meeting time after time, it's like sitting down, you press a play button, the bureaucracy, and you press stop. That's old school with the cassettes. You get the bureaucracy, press play, and they press stop. I don't see necessarily that the issue sits within the bureaucracy. It sits within government and how they don't get it. It makes really, really robust financial, economic sense that if things aren't working, we need to do something different. So the challenge is up for government. More importantly, we need to be at the table to talk about those solutions.
Yeah. Yeah, self-determination was such a massive...
Well, true self-determination.
True, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, part of Reykjavik. Yeah. And can you tell us, actually, because I know that you're the co-chair of Change the Record, and, you know, talking about this $3.4 billion that governments are spending on imprisonment, like, what are you sort of saying that money could be better spent on?
Well, within Change the Record, for those that don't know, it's Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peak organisations and human rights organisations. Very strong relationships with the Law Council of Australia, Human Rights Law Centre, the Australian Human Rights Commission, so on and so forth. And why I say that is because, may I talk black and white because that's my world, black fellas don't normally work with white fellas. And the Change the Record coalition is something that's never been done before. And I know with Ruth and with Ben Parodi at the Human Rights Law Centre, Shockman, we've actually reached out to non-Indigenous people to say, we need to do this together, we can't do it alone. So leaders can lead and leaders can be led. We've come up with something which isn't new, and it's not rocket science. It's part of the policy solutions, which have been around for ages, and the legislative solutions. So 12 principles, but more importantly, as those 12 principles, is about underpinning it in very strong public policy. Mm. So we've been lobbying the Tories before they came into power, and Labor in power, and now it's vice versa. Ourselves and our collective of part of Change of Record have been lobbying and getting very consistent on the messages to establish justice targets, and it sits underneath the Safe Communities block and the Close the Gap process. But more importantly, trying to convince government that justice isn't just about incarceration rates. It works off the principles which underpin it of social justice. And that's looking at understanding that to reduce the incarceration rates, which is a long-term goal, and the legislation's created by state and territory governments, but more importantly through the national partnership agreements, is making sure that your dollars, taxpayers' dollars, are being utilised in the most cost-effective and cost-efficient way with measurable outcomes. So it's about do this and you'll get that. You go back, each state and territory, if I took 10 young people out of jail for a year, because we harp on around justice reinvestment, and I've got $1.6 million to reinvest back into frontline service delivery, I just, for the likes of me, I just don't get why they can't see the financial, the economic, and building strong, resilient communities by just taking a bloody simple financial approach.
Yeah. I want to pick up on something that you said earlier, and that is that women are the fastest growing prisoner demographic in Australia. And Ruth, I thought I might ask you, Miss Dew was a young woman who tragically died in police custody in regional Western Australia a little over 2 years ago now. I know you've been working on this case along with the Aboriginal Legal Service of Western Australia, ALSWA. And so can you tell us a little bit about where it's up to and what changes you think could actually come from these tragic circumstances?
Just for context, just to build on what Carly was saying, Ms. Dew, a really young woman who in her teenage years was arrested for really low-level offences, so swearing and I think maybe an offensive behaviour charge. But even if we go back to that stage, she was a young Aboriginal woman who was never given the opportunity to be cautioned or to be diverted. She was immediately arrested and taken before a magistrate. She was sentenced before a magistrate in both the Broome and then the South Hedland courts, and they're obviously both regional areas of Western Australia. Community corrections is notoriously underfunded in those regions, so it's just a guess, but my guess is that the magistrate probably didn't have available to them a community work order sentence because there was no funding for any work and there was no funding for supervision of that order, and so a magistrate elected a financial penalty, probably very much knowing that she wasn't going to be able to pay that penalty. She then moved around a bit, and the fine system in Western Australia is that it automatically converts to a community work order. Notices were sent to an address she didn't live at. And then, so obviously she wasn't aware, the order converted to being imprisonment in lieu of that fine default. So she, police had a warrant that said, sorry, they essentially had to arrest her and lock her up. When they arrested her, she was in a family violence situation, and the police very much knew about that situation. They arrested her at the same time that they arrested her partner, who was being arrested for a breach of an intervention order. And then over the next 3 days, she increasingly became exceptionally unwell. She was taken by police to the South Hedland Hospital on two occasions. On both of those occasions, she was triaged and seen by doctors in astonishingly small amounts of times. On one occasion, I think it was well and truly under 20 minutes, and if any of you or us have been to an emergency waiting room and waited and then been able to see a doctor, you can appreciate how quick that is. And on the third day she was in custody, she was disbelieved the entire time, told by police that she was faking her pain. And on the third day she was manifestly unwell. She was taken to the hospital in cardiac arrest. The hospital tried for 40 minutes to revive her and couldn't. That happened August 2 years ago. She was 22 at the time. It took Western Australia close to 2 years to list the matter for a coronial inquest. And that's an expedited coronial inquest there. You can imagine the grief that the family has had to live with. And to have to wait 2 years to get literally any correspondence from government, from police, from the hospital around why their granddaughter, their daughter, their sister, their auntie died in these circumstances has been horrific. And I should say, as a non-Aboriginal person, it's often, you know, we can talk in concepts or numbers or figures or injustices, but working with Carol Rowe, Misty's grandmother, and her family, it's just so palpable that these beautiful people's lives have been irrevocably changed. And I think what is so painful is that she's somebody who should have never been locked up in the first place. One of the Royal Commission recommendations was that imprisonment should not be used for fine default. It's a clear recommendation that the Western Australian government has ignored. What's probably an equally big slap in the face is that since her death, the Western Australian government has refused to change that legislation, has refused to remove imprisonment as a fine default option, despite having a really good model to look to in New South Wales where they haven't locked anybody up for fine default. Western Australia also doesn't have a custody notification system whereby the Aboriginal Legal Service is notified when an Aboriginal person comes into custody so that they can do a welfare check and a legal check on that person. There's a suite of other problems in Western Australia, but it's a case that is ongoing, and needless to say, the family is still waiting for some semblance of answers and for a sense of truth as to why their lives have been so irreversibly changed for the worse.
I think that's a really good point that you raise. I think often we can talk about statistics, and to actually really talk about the person and the people behind those statistics and the impacts that this has actually had on their families is really critical. And you mentioned the recommendation in terms of, you know, fine default, but, you know, even thinking further back in terms of Miss Du's life, before she was given that opportunity for diversion, the recommendations, you know, 79, 80, 81 that relate to, you know, abolishing public drunkenness as being an offence and also swearing, offensive language. And, you know, which of those jurisdictions have actually done that is something for us to examine. But I do want to talk to you, Magistrate Fella, about your experiences in the Koori Court. I know that as a magistrate you often sit in the Koori Court here in Victoria, and I might even ask Shane to jump in a little bit to talk about the Murray Courts as well in Queensland. But, you know, if you can tell us a little bit about, you know, how the Koori Courts are working, whether you think they're working, and also if you've had any exposure to other Indigenous-specific courts.
Sure. Well, we, the, as I mentioned earlier, Shepparton and Broadmeadows were the first to launch. They were deliberately chosen, one being in regional Victoria, one being in suburban Melbourne, and we appreciated there was going to be different challenges with respect to here in Victoria, in Melbourne and at Broadmeadows, with the different number of mobs within our community. And so recruiting of the elders and respected persons was something that we took very seriously, and so the local community people up in Shepparton and were appointed, as were elders and respected persons down here in Broadmeadows. For some people that may not know what the Koori Court is and what it's about, is the magistrate comes off the bench and sits at the bar table with the police prosecutor, the defence solicitor, the accused, his or her support person, a Koori Court officer that's an Aboriginal person that's employed by the court to be a first the support person to the Koori accused, and elders and respected persons at the bar table. We generally try and have a male and a female, obviously, for obvious reasons, and corrections also sit at the bar table. The Koori courts have now in Victoria, across all three jurisdictions, being the Children's Court, Magistrates Court, and also the County Court. What the addition in the Children's Court, which is, I think, a stroke of genius, but one that probably should have been thought of earlier, was also having the Department of Education sit at the table as well, so that the child, as part of any sort of sentencing option or deferral of sentence or working with youth justice, does have a day program allocated to them. So that's really crucial to have them reconnected with education or a form of education, as well as obviously participating with the elders and respected persons. The sentence itself is solely imposed by the magistrate, judge, or the magistrate in the Children's Court. So we need to make that very clear to the accused people and people in court that it is still the magistrate making the decision. But what is the key to Koori Court is the cultural conversation that takes place at the bar table between the accused and the elders and respected persons. Now, I don't mind a chat, I have to say. So it's a real skill for me to actually shut up for a change and push my chair back and actually allow for the elders to take over that part of the conversation. And it is very much allowing where you know my place, really, to allow that to take place. And it might just be a driving offence that's before the court, but you start pulling the thread for that young person or the person that's before the court and start to identify why it is that he or she might be offending. And levels of trauma are not that far under the surface. So you can actually see, for an unlicensed driving charge, the young person's in a flood of tears before you. And it's about acknowledging. And there's a level of shame and disappointment that they've let their elders down. And that's part of and it's been recognised in the Court of Appeal here in Victoria in the case of Morgan, that appearing in Koori Court and participating in that process is a mitigatory factor in terms of sentence. So that's really important, because as we know, if you have a matter in the mentioned court at any court, the plea might be over in 5 minutes and you're walking out the door with your sentence, and you as an accused person have not seen a thing, and you're relying entirely on your solicitor if you're represented, because a lot of people are not. You hope your solicitor has put all those things on your behalf. In Victoria, I also just want to pick up on the diversion and cautioning. I know I'm going a bit off track, but I'll make this quick. There is a real push in Victoria for us to be working with police about the number of children and also Koori people being accessing cautions, but also where the Chief Magistrate has just launched a... well, it's not a pilot, because it's going to happen, a Koori diversion list, starting off at the Melbourne Magistrates Court and also in Mildura, and that ultimately will come to Broadmeadows as well. And that, as people may appreciate, it is the police who are the gatekeepers with respect to that. They must consent to diversion. Even if I, as the judicial officer, think it's worthy of diversion, if the police say no, that's the end of it. But what we're working very closely, and the police have been part of these discussion processes about looking at increasing our numbers of those eligible for diversion that are Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander. Unfortunately, and this is not new, that what we're finding is, I could
tell you on one hand the number of people being afforded diversion. And that's why we were concerned about, because it's going to be listed on a Koori Court sitting day, how that might impact on our lists. And unfortunately, the staff at the Magistrates Court have indicated, well, we don't expect it's going to be much because our numbers are so low at the moment. But that's certainly something that we, as a court, and working with, collaboratively with the police, is trying to improve those numbers. And hopefully, with children as well, having them ultimately diverted through from the criminal justice system.
Jane, you've recently just had an inquiry announced in Queensland in relation to youth detention. We've also got the Royal Commission into the protection and detention of children in the Northern Territory. And I also note that Chapter 14 of the National Report really focused on the overwhelming statistics of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander juveniles who made up that custodial population. I was wondering, we actually don't have a great deal of time left, but I'm really keen to hear about some of the recent changes that are going on in Queensland.
Pardon me, the announcement last week by Premier Palaszczuk is that we're the only state or territory in Australia that still locks 17-year-old up in adult prisons. So there's a bill going before Parliament, which I would suggest would rectify that. There's also cards on the table in relation to making the legal age of criminal responsibility, moving it up from 10 until 12 in line with the Convention on the Rights of the Child. So there's some really good processes happening. And look, a part of the inquiry that was announced by the Premier, they were forced into it by the shocking video footage that came out with getting private security guards with Alsatians or German Shepherds, taking them into the cell blocks on long leads, unmuzzled, chasing the kids, squat and waddle, strip searches, whole range of tactics we know, which are a breach of many international conventions. So Professor Megan Davis has been appointed, which I think is fantastic, and we've also got a very affable QC who's in there. So, look, time will tell. There's been Royal Commissions in the past, Bath reports, reports everywhere. The answers are already there.
On that note, we might actually open it up to the audience to ask a range of questions of our panel members. So I think there's a couple of roving mics that are moving around, so for those of you who want to ask a question, please just pop your hand up.
Hi, I was a little bit late getting here because of the rain, so I apologise if you've already addressed this, but my interest is in the actual number of deaths in custody. Has that changed in 25 years?
I can kick it off if you like. There's been almost 400 deaths in custody since the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody handed down its report. There were 99 deaths investigated, so I will let you do the maths on that one. In the last couple of months, and I shouldn't actually say, it's in the last 2 months only.
Sorry, can I just interrupt? I'm interested if it's changed, not the actual numbers. Like, is that 400 in the 25 years a change from what it was?
As in, has it increased or has it decreased? Look, I think the figures are actually saying it's increased.
Absolutely. And may I also say that the where the changes in the deaths in custody are taking place is not so much in police cells, although WA is its own story, is they've actually moved into jails. So in Queensland, in the last 4 weeks, we've had three deaths. I talked to our colleagues in Alice Springs over the last couple of days. We've identified 10 deaths across the country within the last few months. So it has shifted from police cells into correctional facilities.
And not everyone hears about those, do they? Like you were telling me just before about a really awful case in Queensland, and that's not in a custodial facility of a child.
Yeah, it was in out-of-home care service, the kid on child protection order. The worker in the residential facility thought he was in the shower for too long, and 20 minutes later he found him hanging by a belt naked in the shower. and this is just ongoing.
Next question.
Thank you for, it's a privilege to sit here and listen to you for, so thank you for sharing everything you are. I kind of disagree just with something Shane was saying, in that I don't think this is a political thing or a bureaucracy. Nations change these sort of things. Australia has changed these sort of things in the past. My question to any of the four of you, the longest, oldest living culture on earth, the longest continuing art tradition in the world, why don't we care? Why don't we care? How do we get it to the people of Australia to demand the politicians change these horrendous statistics?
Maybe I'll just add to that and then throw it over to you three. I think, I've said this before, I think if we look at the Royal Commission into Institutional Abuse, it would be pretty unfathomable for us to imagine for that Royal Commission to run its course, take all of the evidence it will take, make a list of recommendations, 25 years later have a political situation where those recommendations haven't been implemented and abuse continues. That situation I don't think Australia would ever tolerate, but we're in a situation with the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody where Australia as a whole is very much tolerating governments around Australia and a Commonwealth government failing to do what needs to be done to address injustice. And certainly from my perspective, that's one of the biggest human rights issues facing this country.
For me, it's really shocking that it takes an investigative journalist to put pictures on our television for some real changes to be made, and swiftly, because the Royal Commission was announced quite swiftly. And in June of this year, there were a number of peak Aboriginal organisations at the national level that, as you might remember, during that election period, you probably didn't hear anything about Aboriginal affairs, as we don't during most election periods. And those peak organisations said, you know what, we have to do something about this. Yeah. We have to unite and we have to actually demand that, you know, the things that are part of seminal reports over the last 25 years are actually acted upon. Mm. And so during the election period, and it was quite a historic moment, a number of those peak Aboriginal organisations and supporting organisations like the Human Rights Law Centre, like Amnesty International and a range of other stakeholders joined forces to launch the Redfern Statement, which was to say, you know what, we've got all of these recommendations, we've got the answers, engage with us. And we're actually starting to see a bit of shift on that. You know, the federal government is talking about holding workshops with us now to work through some of the recommendations in that statement. And so I think there is, and perhaps we need to be optimistic about this, because otherwise you just don't get out of bed in the morning, right? Mm-hmm. But there's change coming and we've got to keep working.
Can I just pick up on one of the points as well, is that often a lot of people will read the papers and think how horrific this offending may have been, whatever is contained within the news articles within it, and demand that the person be jailed, the most appropriate sentence for that person, get them off the street and jail them so that they're no longer a threat to the community. And some of that might have merit. I'm not quibbling at that. What I am saying, though, is that, and I'm going back to the Ombudsman's report, she has indicated that 99% of people will be released. And what the thinking needs to be is the community going to be safer that they've just served a straight sentence of jail upon their release? Mm. Or do you look at ways in which you might be able to rehabilitate a person, either
by way of being in the community or as part of a combination sentence where there's a short term of imprisonment and a community corrections order, or as conditions of parole. I think we need to start turning our mindset about what are our expectations of us as a community. Is our community going to be safer by an immediate jail term? Possibly, but 99% of the time people will be released, and we need to make sure that we're addressing the actual behaviour as to why people are offending so that they're not re-offending and the community safer.
And if I may, just a short one, you know about politics. You don't get into politics unless you want to become the government. We've seen prime ministers climb over each other, the jigsaw puzzle moving around, and tough on crime wins votes. I don't get into politics, not I. People don't get into politics, they don't want to form government and someone wants to climb to the top and be the Premier or the Chief Minister or the Prime Minister. So they get in there on tough on crime. And once they're in there, they're in power. You don't go into politics to be in opposition all your life.
I think one more question.
Hi there. What has the impact of the privatisation of prisons had and the lack of rehabilitation and education programs within those prisons had? Because it seems that you said how the rising incarceration of lots more people, and it seems like the private prisons need this population to increase.
Oh, sorry, I'm doing a lot of talking. You know about neoliberalism, Thatcherism. I thought it was funny, I think last week in The Australian, Tony Blair came out, the former UK Prime Minister, and said social impact bonds or social benefit bonds do not work directly in relation to social programs. Mm. And I thought, well, Serco, as the privatised prisons in the UK, were delivering prison services, now they control all the social sector in the UK. So it's happening at the federal level, it's actually happening with Labor in Queensland, and really what the neoliberalism or social impact bonds are about is saying that the private sector has to put money into the public purse. It's about you invest dollars and over a 7 to 10 year period you get a return on your investment, you get a dividend. So they're putting pressure on the private sector and corporates to actually take social responsibility for government. And that's a very short version. But
yeah. I think that's actually all we've got time for. I would like to thank our panellists, so if we can have a round of applause for those that have joined us.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.